and everything I shall say here will to some extent rest upon a compromise, in so far, that is, as I take the common standpoint of every day, and embrace the error which is at the bottom of it. My remarks, therefore, will possess only a qualified value, for the very word eudaimonology is a euphemism. Further, I make no claims to completeness, partly because the subject is inexhaustible, and partly because I should otherwise have to say over again what has been already said by others. The only book composed, as far as I remember, with a like purpose to that which animates this collection of aphorisms, is Cardan's De Utilitate Ex Adversis Capienda, which is well worth reading, and may be used to supplement the present work. Aristotle, it is true, has a few words on eudaimonology in the fifth chapter of the first book of his Rhetoric, but what he says does not come to very much. As compilation is not my business, I have made no use of these predecessors, more especially because in the process of compiling, individuality of view is lost, and individuality of view is the kernel of works of this kind. In general, indeed, the wise in all ages have always said the same thing, and the fools, who at all times form the immense majority, have in their way too acted alike, and done just the opposite, and so it will continue. For, as Voltaire says, we shall leave this world as foolish and as wicked as we found it on our arrival. The Wisdom of Life. Chapter 1. Division of the Subject. Aristotle, 1, divides the blessings of life into three classes, those which come to us from without, those of the soul, and those of the body. Keeping nothing of this division but the number, I observe that the fundamental differences in human lot may be reduced to three distinct classes, 1, what a man is, that is to say, personality, in the widest sense of the word, under which are included health, strength, beauty, temperament, moral character, intelligence, and education. 2. What a man has, that is, property and possessions of every kind. 3. How a man stands in the estimation of others, by which is to be understood, as everybody knows, what a man is in the eyes of his fellow men, or, more strictly, the light in which they regard him. This is shown by their opinion of him, and their opinion is in its turn manifested by the honor in which he is held, and by his rank and reputation. The differences which come under the first head are those which nature herself has set between man and man, and from this fact alone we may at once infer that they influence the happiness or unhappiness of mankind in a much more vital and radical way than those contained under the two following heads, which are merely the effect of human arrangements. Compared with genuine personal advantages, such as a great mind or a great heart, all the privileges of rank or birth, even of royal birth, are but as kings on the stage, to kings in real life. The same thing was said long ago by Metrodorus, the earliest disciple of Epicurus, who wrote as the title of one of his chapters, "The happiness we receive from ourselves is greater than that which we obtain from our surroundings," 1, and it is an obvious fact, which cannot be called in question, that the principal element in a man's well-being, indeed, in the whole tenor of his existence, is what he is made of, his inner constitution. For this is the immediate source of that inward satisfaction or dissatisfaction resulting from the sum total of his sensations, desires and thoughts, whilst his surroundings, on the other hand, exert only a mediate or indirect influence upon him. This is why the same external events or circumstances affect no two people alike. Even with perfectly similar surroundings, every one lives in a world of his own. For a man has immediate apprehension only of his own ideas, feelings, and volitions. The outer world can influence him only in so far as it brings these to life. The world in which a man lives shapes itself chiefly by the way in which he looks at it, and so it proves different to different men. To one it is barren, dull, and superficial, to another rich, interesting, and full of meaning. On hearing of the interesting events which have happened in the course of a man's experience, many people will wish that similar things had happened in their lives too, completely forgetting that they should be envious rather of the mental aptitude which lent those events the significance they possess when he describes them. To a man of genius they were interesting adventures, but to the dull perceptions of an ordinary individual they would have been stale, everyday occurrences. This is in the highest degree the case with many of Goethe's and Byron's poems, which are obviously founded upon actual facts, where it is open to a foolish reader to envy the poet because so many delightful things happen to him,